KALW.
In the U.S., we tend to concentrate so much on economic metrics like GDP, stock markets.
That's how we've been measuring our progress as a country. But what about the state?
The hallmark of our work is the American Human Development Index, and that's a measure that combines the best available data on health, education, and income.
How one group says we should be measuring how California is doing. Then Black people are diagnosed with autism later than other groups. Why?
The research 40 years ago exclusively was white boys, so it left out girls and women altogether.
We hear from a Black autistic advocate. And Petaluma cheesemonger Rory Stamp reads from his new book. That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. When it comes to measuring how well a country's doing, many people look to things like GDP or the stock market, economic indicators. But does that give us a good idea about how people are doing? What about how many people have access to education or quality health care? Those are the things that matter to Kristen Lewis. She's director of Measure of America, a nonprofit that studies well-being. Their latest report is on California, and she says using indicators tied to health, learning, and earnings, we get a better picture of our state that helps us tackle social issues in a more effective way. Kristen joined me to explain their findings and what they're calling the five Californias.
In the U.S., we tend to concentrate so much on economic metrics like GDP, stock markets, things like this. And, you know, that information is super important, of course. But if we use economic indicators like these as a proxy for social progress and people's well-being, we get kind of an incomplete and sometimes pretty misleading picture. So we really need to pay much more attention to data on the well-being of ordinary people. The hallmark of our work is the American Human Development Index, and that's a measure that combines the best available data on health, education, and income. So those are kind of three fundamental building blocks of a good life into a single number that falls on a scale from 0 to 10.
You know, one thing that struck me was this idea in your report of five Californias. So can you take us through the five Californias and what they are?
Sure. I'd be happy to. So what we've done is create these five Californias based on scores on the Human Development Index. And we calculated scores for 265 places in California. So when we sorted these 265 kind of neighborhood and county clusters according to the Human Development Index, we got these five Californias. So 1% California, which are areas that score above a 9 on the Human Development Index. These are just neighborhoods basically in the Bay Area. If you look, say, at life expectancy in 1% California, it's 86.1 years. So the average for California as a whole is 81 years. So people in this California are living 5 years longer. The second California is what we call Elite Enclave California. And those are places that score between 7 and 9, roughly. People in this California, again, this is really concentrated in Bay Area, LA, San Diego. It's about 20% of California's population. And the score there is 8.15. And people living there, again, are living longer lives than the average Californian, but not as long as 1% Californian. So they're living to 84.8 years.
And this group is about 8 million people, about a fifth of the state's population, it says. And then you have Main Street California, which all of a sudden the number of people in this group jumps to more than 18 million people.
Right. And so again, let's look at life expectancy. So for California as a whole, it's 81 years. Here it's 82.3 years, so a little bit above the average life expectancy, but much shorter than what we were seeing in 1% in Elite Enclave California. And median personal earnings are about $39,000.
Mm-hmm. And so let's go to struggling California, you call it. What is that one?
this California tends to be more concentrated in the rural parts of Northern California, in the Inland Empire, in the San Joaquin Valley. So, and in some neighborhoods within big metros like Los Angeles.
The last category you have is really interesting because you're saying that no neighborhood and no town cluster is part of disenfranchised California this year compared to 9 in the portrait of 2014 to 2015 and 11 that qualified to be called disenfranchised in 2011. So this looks like things are getting better.
Yeah, so this was a really optimistic or kind of heartening finding, I guess I could say. So the floor has gone up, and that is really good news. So none of these 265 neighborhood clusters in California is now scoring below 3 on our index. So again, that's great news. We kept the category for a couple of reasons. One, just sort of historically to show progress over time. We kept that category and for comparability. We also kept it for a less sort of sanguine reason, which is we don't really know what's going to happen to the score when we start to incorporate the years of the COVID pandemic.
Right. And there's so much in this report. We obviously can't cover all of it in this interview, but I also want to talk about, you measure California's youth disconnection rate. You measured the share of teens and young adults who are not working and they're not in school, and that number has actually gone lower for the past decade. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So the youth disconnection rate nationally has fallen. It was kind of at a high in 2010, following the Great Recession. The youth disconnection kind of knock-on effects were quite strong for several years. And then finally, it started to drop. And our data are from 2019 for this report. So it's sort of the eve of the pandemic, in a sense. And we saw in California, like in other places, the youth disconnection rate dropping still further. Just to define youth disconnection, what we're talking about is young people between the ages of 16 and 24 who are neither working nor in school. So even though the aggregate is good news, the rate for California as a whole dropping, we see tremendous difference by race and ethnicity in the state. So the rate for Asian young people is about 6%. For white young people, about 9%, Latino young people, about 11%. And then there's a significant jump. Native American young people have about 18.4% of young people are disconnected out of school and out of work. And for Black Californian young people, the rate is 23.2%. So almost 1 in 4 young people.
And so in this report, you also have, because, you know, reading all of these findings, one is definitely left with a sense of, well, what are some solutions? And you kind of explore solutions in recommendations and a plan of action. In one part, in the education area, what is one big thing that can happen to decrease this disparity in terms of, for example, if we take the example of the disconnected youth and these huge differences in numbers between Black youth, for example, and Asian youth or white youth, what are one or two things that you recommend that can change that?
Sure. So I guess in our COVID era, the first thing we have to do is really address the disparate impact of COVID-19 on communities of color, particularly. And we've seen that being out of school for long periods of time really hurt young people, especially vulnerable young people. I mean, imagine you're kind of tenuously attached to school, maybe you're at risk of dropping out, and then suddenly you have to go online school. I mean, it was such a challenging situation. So helping young people really recover from COVID, I think it needs to be the first priority. And then prioritizing high quality early childhood care and education is really important. I mean, investing in young children is something that pays dividends across the life course for people themselves, young people, and for society as a whole.
All of that costs money, and all of that needs political will. You know, in putting out these recommendations, do you see there is political will and there is community will to get some of them done?
I think there is. I am an inveterate optimist. And we have to remember that this didn't just happen by happenstance. It didn't just magically happen. It's not just some sort of natural turn of events, but it happened because of decisions that people in power, you know, most of them white, made over centuries. So, you know, those decisions were really designed to capture and maintain economic and social and political dominance through some really ugly things, violence and hate. And they continue to affect well-being today. But just as we as a society made decisions that led to inequitable outcomes, we can make different decisions that lead to more equitable outcomes. And that's important for everybody.
Kristin Lewis is director of Measure of America, a group that studies well-being. Their latest report is called A Portrait of California. We've got a link to it at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Our next segment today comes from The Stoop, a podcast telling stories from across the Black diaspora, hosted by me and Leela Day. One of the things we learned from my interview with Kristin Lewis is that Black communities are left behind when it comes to accessing education. Another area of disparity is healthcare, and this is clear when it comes to autism. In the Black community, there's a good chance you won't know you're autistic until you're grown up. The CDC estimates that autism affects 1 in 44 children in this country, but a child that's autistic and Black is less likely to be diagnosed early. And one big reason is lack of access to health care. In this excerpt, we're going to hear from Diane Wright, a biracial Black woman who was diagnosed with autism as an adult. Now she's a disabilities advocate working in the film and television industries. She explains the dangers that come with being overlooked and left out. Here's Diane.
The research 40 years ago exclusively was white boys, so it left out girls and women altogether and left out people of color altogether. In the last handful of years, quite literally, like handful of years, that's begun to change. But still, when you're overlooked and left out, as you know, that shapes the policy of the places you live in. That shapes the attitudes of the society you live in. You cease to exist for a lot of reasons. And for us as the Black community, not being seen translates into being seen as other and being seen as bad a lot of the time. So autistic behavior gets seen as bad behavior, bad attitudes, willfulness, laziness, even criminality.
And this, Leela, is where Diane says things can get dangerous.
We are following breaking news out of Colorado, where the state attorney general announced that a grand jury has charged 3 officers and 2 paramedics in the 2019 death of Elijah McClain. The 23-year-old Black man was in a neck restraint and injected with a sedative in a Denver suburb, stopped as he was walking home from the store, according to a city investigation.
We lost Elijah McClain. I mean, that was probably the most gentle, sweet person. And he was seen as threatening because he behaved differently. So, not a white people thing.
Yeah, I remember the story about Elijah. He was 23 years old in Colorado, and in 2019, he was walking home from buying his brother an iced tea at a convenience store. And he was also autistic. There was a 911 call that said he was suspicious, and when the police arrived, they said he resisted. They then injected him with ketamine to sedate him, and he died of a heart attack.
Diane says that if society saw more Black autistic people in media, television, films, online, that would help change stereotypes about Black people. But there are things that are changing representation, like in this PBS kids show, Daniel Tiger.
Hi, Max. Can I play with you?
This year, they introduced this new character, Max. So Max is autistic and he's Black. In this scene, the main character, Daniel Tiger, is in his preschool class, and Max is kind of off to the side by himself, playing with some toy trains.
Do you want to play with me, Max?
Daniel keeps trying to ask Max to play, but he just won't answer. So the teacher comes in. She is also Black.
Why isn't Max answering me?
Well, Daniel, sometimes he needs more time to understand the question and decide how to answer. Let's give him some time.
And now there's something else we need to talk about here, because Diane is not just saying that this is something that white people need to understand to be able to recognize autism in Black people. She's saying Black people need to do some work, too.
Mm-hmm. She is. And she has plenty to say about the internal work that we need to do as Black people, Black families, Black communities, about the stigma that we associate with being neurodivergent. And part of her work is explaining it to Black families.
And if you've not heard the term neurodivergence before, it's a shared way of experiencing the world. And you think of biodiversity as all the ways that life lives on our planet. That's a concept we can get, biodiversity. Neurodiversity is similar, but with respect to neurological makeup. Autism is not a collection of deficits, any more than curly hair is a lack of having straight hair or black skin is a lack of having white skin. We just exist as people. Tall people, gay people, left-handed people, autistic people.
And Diane also says that a lot of the time, people get punished or shunned by their families because they think they're being rude or acting out. And that starts at childhood.
So when you have parents who are yelling at you and smacking you to sit right, talk right, act right, like we might move our bodies in ways to help us cope and regulate or just to express joy that other kids or other adults find inappropriate. Like if you're in church, what are you doing? Why are you making noise? This is not the time. I have heard stories in my community of parents and other family members, you know, physical, verbal abuse. Exclusion is a hard one. When you're excluded from family, from the people who love you, that is a huge punishment. Being talked about as that one, so that the entire family treats you as that one.
And speaking of church, another thing Diane says Black folks do.
Praying it away. Either their family praying for them or making them go and pray for extended amounts of time to heal them.
And so for a lot of autistic people, shifting from family settings to social ones like college, that is really a lot of work for them. A lot of masking or trying to hide their reactions to things.
And you still have to show up and look like you're up for it and have the right tone of voice and have the right facial movements and all these things that are not natural to you. It's exhausting.
And there's something else Diane says that Black communities really need to work on. The fear that a loved one may be labeled. You know, on top of all the other labels we have to live with as Black people.
Mm-hmm.
That's real.
But what the label of autism will give that person is self-knowledge and community. If someone makes fun of you because you, I don't know, flap your hands and when you're happy, which turns out I do. I did not realize I do that, but I do. You're going to be okay with it. You're going to be like, I'm just happy. whatever, as opposed to feeling othered and pushed away. But if you're just labeled with weirdo or, I don't know, all the horrible things people say, there's no way to come out of that.
But one thing that Diane thinks a lot of people don't see is a certain joy that she says autistic people feel much more than other people.
There's a term we use, autistic joy. It's like everyone else's joy, but, you know, uniquely ours. The hallmark of our lives is our deep experience of pretty much everything, right? So just as we see things maybe too brightly or hear things too loudly, we also experience color and music and scents and things really, like, a lot of us are super tasters. Like, there's so much experience to be had, which is a lot of the reason we don't ever want it taken away.
That was an excerpt from the episode Black, Grown, and Autistic from the Stoop podcast, hosted by me and Leela Day. You can hear the full episode on your podcast player, and we've also got it up at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we're going to hear from a Petaluma cheesemonger. It's another episode of KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Rory Stamp lives in Petaluma. His book, Cheese Illustrated, came out in August.
It's an illustrated guide to 50 of my favorite cheese styles from around the world. Here's one of my favorite sections of Cheese Illustrated, where I talk about my time competing for the title of World's Best Cheesemonger in Tours, France. Armed with an indulgent assortment of nearly 50 pounds of cheese, I set off at a feverish pace to construct a surrealist tribute to the iconic works of Salvador Dali. Hastened by the 90-something degree heat and the beating studio lights, I stretched oozing wheels of Brie de Meaux to make dripping clocks and scooped eyeballs for Mahone, arranged peacock feathers around a bouquet of Tetemuan flowers, and built an Art Deco checkerboard from tiles of Taleggio. The centerpiece of the display featured a Craigslist chandelier I lugged across the Atlantic in my overweight luggage, and I piled it high with dripping époisses and dangling reels of pecorino. In the tremendous heat, weeping Valencé slumped onto the crushed red velvet display, and impossible stacks of Comté teetered, while Parmigiano Reggiano crumbles mounded like anthills by shimmering bronze goblets.
That was Rory Stamp reading from Cheese Illustrated.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more at kalw.org/newarrivals. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist. This is San Francisco jazz group Travis Geyer Trio. They'll be playing in Sausalito at the No Name Bar tomorrow night. Thank you. Today's Cross Currents team includes DeAndre Ball, Ryan Housel, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tense, Shirin Adil, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.